Jim Birch of the Defense Criminal Investigative Service in the Office of Inspector General at the Department of Defense. Thank you very much for joining me today, Mr. Birch. Give me an overview of what DCIS does and how it fits into the Office of Inspector General. Thanks for your time today, Jim.
Sure, glad to. Well, DCIS, Defense Criminal Investigative Service, was created in 1981, and we are the criminal investigative arm of the Department of Defense Inspector General's office. Our main priorities, as any inspector general, is to identify or prevent waste, fraud, and abuse, and most of our time is spent on the fraud portion of that. Our priorities are procurement fraud, healthcare fraud, public corruption, product substitution, including counterfeit parts, counterproliferation, and other thefts, large thefts, and miscellaneous crimes that have to do with the programs and operations of the Department of Defense.
A whole lot there to tear into, and we'll do it through the course of the conversation. Tell me about the core of people that helps you pursue these cases, and particularly the special agent group there. What's the job description and the skill set for people who work as special agents in your office?
Well, we hired the GS-1811, which is a standard coding for a criminal investigator that works for the federal government, whether it be FBI or ATF. Criminal investigators are hired under the GS-11 position description. We go through training, and obviously we are in the fraud business. We work a lot of procurement fraud, a lot of complex fraud cases, so we train for that particular avenue. And I must say, I won't do one of these interviews without it saluting our administrative support staff. Even though everything's geared for the 1811, for the criminal investigator on the street, doing the cases and working the cases, our administrative support staff and our analytical support staff, we do nothing without them. And so we have a cadre of special agents, probably around 350 or 60 special agents, but the remainder of our about 410 or 20 employees are administrative support and technical support and analytical support. So, you know, we are gun carrying. We go through all the training, use of force training. Like I say, we concentrate on our criminal investigative techniques. We abide by the U.S. Attorney, the Attorney General guidelines, as well as the SIGI Council of Inspector Generals for efficiency and effectiveness in government. We go by their guidelines as well, and we do emphasize a great deal on our training, especially when it comes to the use of weapons and the use of force.
Mr. Birch, what are the priorities for DCIS as the new fiscal year begins? You mentioned a couple of the areas of emphasis where a lot of your casework is done. Does that comport with your priority list?
Yes, it does. And I, as I said before, and I briefly went over procurement fraud, which relates to false claims, defective pricing, cost mischarging, kickbacks between subcontractors and prime contractors. Another heading is public corruption, which basically is bribery, gratuities, and conflict of interest. We also work product substitution. This is where counterfeit products are put into the system by falsified testing or inferior or non-conforming materials or counterfeit materials that may be, produced for a cheaper fashion and slipped into the system to increase the profit for the contractor that's doing that type of activity. And also, we have investigations at counterproliferation investigations dealing with the exporting of sensitive military technology and international traffic in arms and regulations, ITAR violations, basically. Cyber crimes, intrusions into DoD networks, including contractors who fail to follow their contractual obligations to safeguard the networks of DoD, and healthcare fraud, which is upcoding and kickbacks to physicians, unnecessary services and billing for services that are not rendered. That's where we focus. That's not all of the cases that we work, but that's predominantly where we are going to spend our time, and we're also going to spend our training.
On the counterfeit materials part, the department's made a lot of effort in focusing industry on that issue. Do you find that most of the cases that you pursue around counterfeit materials are malicious, where somebody's deliberately and intentionally and with full knowledge trying to fool the department? Or do you find that most of the cases involve ignorance, where the vendor was not really careful and maybe didn't do due diligence, but wasn't really intending to use counterfeit parts, or does it not even really matter as you're pursuing these cases?
Well, as we're pursuing them, our mantra, if you will, is to protect the warfighter. So we pursue any allegation or any information that comes to our attention where there's counterfeit parts or even substandard parts. We pursue those vigorously. And it doesn't really matter whether it was through ignorance or whether being conspired to do so. We attack that problem, like I said, vigorously. And one of the things that we also do is whenever there is a potential health or safety or a systemic issue, we do the criminal investigations, obviously, to try and catch the bad guys. But the first thing we'll do is we'll notify the component or the controlling authority that there may be a problem with a part or with a counterfeit part or substandard part, something that we come across that could be going into whether it be a weapon or whether it be aircraft or whether it be some other piece of equipment that the warfighter is going to get supplied to use. I know a few years ago there was some armor issues where there were substandard testing. And, of course, as you know, been over in Southwest Asia for a while, this was a real problem. So we do pursue the criminal charges, but we first alert the people in charge to attack the problem, either get whatever that issue is out of the field and correct the issue as soon as we can.
Is it your sense, though, that most of the people that are engaging in this are doing it on purpose, or do they just not know that the stuff they're introducing into the supply chain is bad?
Really haven't looked at it from that angle. Like I say, we just pursue it as soon as we can. And most of the ones that we have, most of the cases end up in some type of prosecutive stage. So the ones that we are pursuing are the ones that are going to be criminally liable. And so I would say that most of the ones that we have on our books are the ones that are actually doing it and are aware of it.
Are there common threads or warning signs about how counterfeit materials get into the supply chain? Are there red flags that people should be aware of as these materials potentially show up to get into the chain?
Well, what we do is we actually depend on the suppliers that we work with. I mean, the best thing that we can do is working with these suppliers. They're the ones that deal with it every day. And I don't mean to cast any dispersions on any supplier out there. We work with them all the time, and they work with us. And they're the ones that actually can tell us right now what's counterfeit, what's not, what's rightfully produced. How do we pick out the ones, really, because they're picking it out. If they get a shipment that has counterfeit products in it, they let us know. And it may not be the DOD contractor themselves. It may be the supplier from somewhere else that's doing this. So that it can be introduced to a supplier, a legitimate supplier, innocently, but they have their own systems of checks and balances where they ensure that they're not putting counterfeit parts into the DOD system.
I want to transition to healthcare fraud, if I can, please, Jim.
Sure.
That is a topic that I would think, of course, the IG's office at VA or HHS, there are other agencies I can think of, would be concerned about. Why is that such a big part of your portfolio? How does that manifest itself, through TRICARE or through other operations inside DOD?
Well, that's correct, and it is a priority for HHS and other agencies as well. But I will tell you, in the DOD, recently, over $30 billion is budgeted in the TRICARE arena or the Defense Health Agency arena. So anything that has that much resources going to it is something that we would focus on. And we work very closely with the people at Defense Health Agency and communicate with them to see what's going on in their world, because it is such a big program, and anything with that big a dollar amount has the ability to be defrauded in some sense. And so we work with them, and we think it's a major investment for the taxpayer and for DOD. So it's something that we pay close attention to.
Within the healthcare fraud arena, what are the big areas of interest? What do you find yourself working on primarily, sir?
Well, we work several various issues, but, you know, like I said, it's over a $30 billion budget in there. There's $9.6 million TRICARE beneficiaries. You know, the Federal Bureau of Investigation recently did a study where healthcare fraud costs the country tens of billions of dollars a year, and the national healthcare expenditures are estimated up to $3 trillion. So it is a major issue that we think we need to look at, and with our partners we do look at very critically. Some of the things we work on are the upcoding, such as billing for more expensive procedures than the ones it's actually incurred, like a facility billing TRICARE for a procedure accomplished by a medical doctor when it was actually performed by a nurse, billing for procedures that were medically unnecessary, corruptions, kickbacks, such as refer patients to specific specialists or prescribing specific medications for durable medical equipment, commonly found in the compounded medication investigations, and also off-label marketing of drugs or medical devices. So that's what we look at.
What is the compounding pharmacies area? That's not an area I know a lot about, sir.
Compounding pharmacies area that we've started looking at in the last two or three years has had a dramatic increase in compounded creams. And what I mean by that, these are creams that are made up, and they're made up for individuals. And so in calendar year 2015, TRICARE paid over $1.5 billion in claims for compounded medications, compared to less than $200 million in all of 2014. These medications have made up to an 85% profit margin. The medications cost anywhere from $1,000 to $20,000. And the reason they charge so much is because they're made for individuals. They're the mixing of various creams and ointments for pain relief. I know DHA, Defense Health Agency, has implemented enhanced controls over these compounds, which has helped a great deal. And the compounding pharmacy is unique because of the extensive networks that are involved. There's various schemes that they use to commit this fraud.
What are the red flags for those? What are the schemes that you've seen common threads of to give people an idea of what they're looking out for?
Well, what happens is the pharmacies will engage marketers or patient recruiters to increase prescriptions. You know, they'll give patients incentives, drugs, meals, iPads, gift cards. Some marketers have reportedly received as much as $5,000 per beneficiary that they recruit. The pharmacies or the marketers engage in agreement with the prescribers to write the prescriptions, and often the prescriber has no relationship with the patient, which is a requirement to bill under the TRICARE program. You know, some of the prescribers are not even located in the same geographical region. The top 10 prescribers have generated over $300 million in paid claims, and the prescribers often receive kickbacks from the marketers or the pharmacies in form of cash. The physicians may also bill TRICARE for a patient visit when they write the prescription, even if an actual visit did not occur. So it's really a marketing scheme cold call, robocall tactics that and some say that they are doing surveys on behalf of TRICARE. Compounding pharmacies also use websites to get TRICARE beneficiaries, saying they will pay anywhere from $200 to $350 a month to join a study. And there really is no study. What they're doing is they're getting names of subscribers so they can use that information to further the compounding scheme.
How do you do educational outreach to let people know that that's about to happen? Or that these things are going on out there?
That actually is part of the agent's required duties is to get out and do fraud prevention awareness schemes. And we're also participating with the Department of Justice in getting out the word to people to, you know, and most of it's not unusual fraud. You know, if you're not initiating the contact, you should be very aware. Or get a second opinion, or to be honest with you, our DOD hotline is a great place for people to call to make inquiries or to file complaints if they hear something or feel that something's not quite right.
What is the long-term solution to these problems? What you're talking about strikes me that it kind of addresses the issue after it happens. Is there some structure that could be put in place that could prevent this the bad apples from doing this in the first place?
Well, there are, and there. I know DHA has reacted to this and put in controls. But you know, part of what we do is a fraud prevention awareness. We just did. Fraud prevention awareness for contracting officers over in Bagram. We talked to 125 and then 77 to talk about trends and talk about systemic issues where the fraud vulnerability exists. And this is no different. This is working with the agencies, working with the department, and finding out what the trends are, what the systemic issues are, and then trying to work with them and have them put in controls that will limit that exposure.
Another limitation of exposure, I imagine, would be if you're able to knock some of these people out of the market. Have you been able to do that?
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that we do. We don't just prosecute people, put them in jail, and then try to take the proceeds of their criminal activity. We have a very robust suspension and debarment. It's not really our suspension and debarment, but we supply the information to the appropriate authorities so that they're able to take action in that arena to bar some of these people and companies from doing business. I know DHA is looking at that. I know we work with the armed services where they do their contracts. So, you know, part of really what law enforcement is supposed to be doing is preventing these crimes. And that's ultimately what we're trying to do. And along the way, we're going to arrest the bad guys and then try to relay what lessons we've learned or what trends there are and get them to the right components so that they can put in as much controls as possible in order to eliminate the fraud if we can.
The final area that I think I'll have time to ask you about today is procurement fraud, Mr. Birch. And that area is something we've seen some high-profile cases in the last several years in the various branches of the military. How does a case like that usually manifest itself? Is it as simple as a tip on one of your hotlines from a whistleblower, or can they be more complicated than that?
It can be all the above. It could be very simply a whistleblower. It could be a hotline referral we get. And a lot of it is out working in the community, in the law enforcement community, and developing partnerships in the community. That's really where you really are able to develop criminal intelligence that even if it's not in our realm, we'll be able to pass it to somebody else, or if somebody else is working something or thinks we have an interest in it, then they can pass it to us. And we work very closely, especially within the DOD confines, with the military criminal investigative organizations, Naval Criminal Investigative Service, the Army Criminal Investigative Division, mainly the Major Procurement Fraud Group, and then the Office of Special Investigations at the Air Force. So, you know, we work very closely with them and other partners. And as we talk about healthcare, we work with HHS and the VA in exchanging information and working cases together. And I'd like to mention also that in our robust training program, we've instituted a routine and recurring healthcare fraud training for our agents, and it's been received very well, and it's getting the information out to our agents so that they can do more fraud prevention briefings and then know what they've got when they come across healthcare fraud.
The final thought is on that cross-collaborative effort. You mentioned VA and HHS. Do you find yourself working with agencies across government on a regular basis? And how do those interactions go with the Inspector General's offices at the other agencies, sir?
Yes, we do. We partner with various agencies. Like I said, I mentioned the military criminal investigative organizations who have a much broader venue of responsibilities than we do, but they're very active in the fraud arena. And we work with various other IG agencies and other agencies such as Homeland Security Investigations, which is a branch of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement. So we partner very well with these other agencies. And I've got to say, we partner very well. And I mentioned our hotline, DOD hotline, which is in the Office of the Inspector General. We partner very well with our audit component. There's been many occasions where they'll be doing an audit of a particular program or operation, and they will refer us a criminal matter. And so we've gotten some criminal investigations from audits. And by the same token, we also provide them information where we see various trends taking place, and we will provide that information to them because it may be an audit that they might be interested in doing. And this compounding is one area where we're working very closely with our audit component. So we work within the OIG with the various components and outside as well.
I misspoke, Mr. Birch, when I said my final thought. This is actually it. How did you wind up in that slot? What is it in your background that led you to this, and what is it in your personal interest that leads you to enjoy your work?
Oh, well, it's mission-driven. That's the bottom line. You know, I grew up in the Secret Service for 27 and a half years, and I went over to the State Department IG for about 20 months and helped develop their criminal investigative program, which is doing very well. And then I came over here in 2009, and I will tell you, the DOD is a huge, what do I want to say, probably one of the biggest businesses in the world, and It's very challenging, but we have a lot of dedicated, mission-driven agents and employees and all components of the OIG to try and make an impact. And, you know, we're looking out for the taxpayer, the warfighter, and the department, and we don't take sides. We go do our mission. So it's really exciting. You know, I've always been a cop, so, you know, I guess the criminal investigative part of it's always been fun, and finding more efficient and effective ways to do those has always been a challenge. And with a great group of people that I work with, it's fun to come to work.
You're walking one of the most financially largest beats in the world, and I imagine one of the most complicated. And it's great to talk to you about it. Thank you very much for your time today, Mr. Birch.
Okay, Mr. Rose. Thank you.